Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, July 15th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Identity Theft, an interview with Bob Sullivan, award-winning journalist. He's the author of Your Evil Twin, Behind the Identity Theft Epidemic. I pre-recorded the interview with Bob this morning. We're going to replay it this evening. I've asked Mike Linton, my assistant producer, to listen tonight and compile a checklist of the recommended actions discussed in the interview. We're going to post it in a link in the archive next week. Identity theft is a real risk. It's important to me that you understand the steps you can take to protect yourself, so if you don't feel like taking notes during the interview, we'll have that checklist up for you next week. First, the top stories in money and markets and some questions from Ask Catherine. The theme for this week is a quote from Frank Herbert, who wrote the science fiction book Dune, talking about spice. The planet in the science fiction book was managed to harvest the spice, which was basically a mineral or material from the planet that could make all the spaceships go. And in it, he says, "Control the spice, and you control everything." Well, as the economy grows weaker, all the centers of political power are looking to squeeze more out of anything, out of the spice, which is anything with juice. Three big sources of that juice this week are money, oil, and food. Let's look at the top stories in money, oil, and food. The top story in money is that the financial reform bill squeaked through the Senate today on a vote of 60-39. In my opinion, with the possible exceptions of derivatives, it addresses none of the causes of the financial coup d'etat and offers no solutions. It simply creates massive new rules for everyone to deal with. I'm skeptical that it's going to seriously address derivatives either. To quote John Taylor, who's head of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, quote, "I will believe reform is here when I see it." What it does do is institute more capital controls, both domestically and globally, and gives much more power to the federal government and the Federal Reserve Bank. According to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, it spawns, you ready for this, 533 new regulations, 60 studies, and 94 reports. On top of the similar regulatory study and report process for healthcare, we're looking at a process designed to be unbelievably burdensome and expensive to any kind of entrepreneurial activity. It's going to hurt the small players across the board, from community banks to small business. It will make startups more expensive and difficult in numerous areas. What that means is it's another real hit by Washington that will increase unemployment. There's a study out this week from the Kauffman Foundation. It's up on the blog. New jobs come from startups. And so when you make it even more difficult for startups to start up, again, bad for employment. My theory that the SEC action against Goldman Sachs is part of the administration's negotiation tactics on the financial reform effort got a boost when shortly after the announcement of the bill passing the Senate and the market closing, the SEC announced a $550 million settlement with Goldman Sachs. We've posted a description on the settlement. We'll try and get a copy if it's made public later this week or tomorrow or next week. What this means essentially is that Goldman Sachs skates. $550 million is a drop in the bucket of what Goldman has made from the various bailouts and all sorts of among other things, getting the ability to create a holding company and use the federal credit during this period. We'll see what happens after the reform bill passes. But essentially, they can make this much money in a week of inside trades. The message of the situation is that there was a squabble between who got more power in the reform bill between the Wall Street Washington partners, but they're still partners, and it has nothing to do with reducing their destruction and control of the economy. Rather, it really has to do with the specifics of how they'll keep it going. But anything that institutes this much complexity is going to be burdensome even for their partnership. So stay tuned for what the financial reform bill will do to Goldman's derivative business and whether they maintain the bank holding company and his loose use of the federal credit that they have had. We're going to be publishing a special Solari report on the financial reform bill at the end of the month, updating the one we did on the version that passed the House, which we've continue to post in the articles archive at Solari.com. A lot of the framework remains the same, so if you want to take a look at that, it's there. The scope of financial reform did not apply to one of the main culprits of financial coup d'etat, and that was the federal government. While the Senate was finishing up the bill, the government quietly announced a moratorium on billions of financial management systems, including at HUD and other agencies throughout the government. The story ran in the Wall Street Journal. Check it out. It's going to be up on the blog tomorrow. Since the laws required it in 1995, the federal government has still not published audited financial statements. At least you can say for the Wall Street firms, they do bother to publish audited financial statements as required by law. Top story in oil is waiting and watching the relief wells being drilled in the Gulf. The mainstream media is filled with remarkably rosy news of progress, while the alternative media continues to be filled with stories of apocalypse now. One is unbelievably rosy, the other almost impossibly dire. I continue to believe that there is much about this story which is hidden, and hope that more information will emerge. In the meantime, Jim Norman called it right, which is about a 50% chance that these relief wells will work. We'll know in August. If they need to drill more, it could take into 2011. So let's just see what August brings. Meantime, the impact on the Gulf economy is unbelievably chilling, and we're going to see that ripple through the rest of the country, along with the state and local cutbacks. The top story in food takes us back down to my county here in Tennessee, Hardeman County, where Evergreen Farm, which is our most wonderful local organic farmer. If you ask me who's my farmer, Evergreen Farm is one of my most important farms, along with Top of the World Farm. They announced they're closing and will auction their cows and lands. It's hard to really express how special they are. If you go to the blog post I wrote that's called Farewell Evergreen Farm, you'll get a sense of it from looking at the pictures. If you go to their website, their graphics are beautiful. Their cows always look happy when you drive by the farm. Literally, the land and the grass shimmers. It's an amazing place. This is in response to a round of state regulation related to their dairy business that will literally make it uneconomic for them to continue. And if you look at the way that food safety is used, it's a very interesting comparison when you bring it just down to the local level. And let me compare this with two stories just to give you a sense of how extraordinary and Orwellian food safety is, or the notion of safety is applied to food. About 3 years ago, I was sitting at a birthday party at a kitchen table with the grandmother of the child who was having the birthday, and the most active fast food restaurant in Bolivar, Tennessee, which is the county seat 10 miles down the road, the kitchen table was full of food from this fast food restaurant. And I wasn't eating any, and the grandmother wasn't eating any. And finally, I very quietly said to her, "How come you're not eating any of the burgers from you know where?" And she said, "Oh, well, I used to work at a local auction company." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, we used to be under instructions to separate out the old, diseased, and cancerous animals for this fast food chain because that would give them much cheaper meat." Now, that fast food chain is operating and is alive and well in Bolivar, Tennessee today as Evergreen Farm is being put out of business by quote-unquote safety regulation. But let me continue. Last year, we had a great crop of soybeans. Soybeans is the third largest crop in the state of Tennessee, hay being number two and marijuana being number one. But we had a great crop of soybeans, and right at the last moment, right before the beans were harvested, we had an incredible period of rain, and it literally destroyed the soybean crop, and they were they just weren't good. They rotted in the field essentially from too much rain. And when some of the local farmers applied for farm insurance, they were told that they couldn't get it, that they had to take the soybeans into the elevators and basically put the soybeans into the food supply. In fact, the government, to save money from having to pay on the crop insurance, was mixing rotten soybeans in with the good soybeans to basically keep the food coming. And talk about a violation of safety. It was absolutely extraordinary. And we watched it basically go down at the same time that we're reading press releases about Michelle Obama's organic garden at the White House. So if you look at what's really happening in food safety in Hardeman County, Tennessee, and I could tell you many more stories, the notion that Evergreen Farm is not safe or their food is not safe is, of course, complete hogwash, which underscores the question of what is really going on. Now, why is this important? In the farewell to Evergreen Farm that I put up on the blog, I posted several links that relate to this story. And one is a wonderful talk that Franklin Sanders gave in Mississippi on local economies and rebuilding local economies and the importance of building local food capacity in local economies. If you look at the amount of the gross national product that comes from food or food processing and food distribution, it's critical. That's one thing we can do locally where we can compete against anybody in the rest of the world, because food grown locally has all sorts of special qualities that it can't have if it ships in from thousands of miles away. It's a wonderful talk. I encourage you to listen to it. It's part of the topic we're going to be talking about in the August Precious Metals Market Report, local economy and the role of precious metals in building local economies. Now, if we want jobs in America, if we want to stop the rising unemployment, and we want to be healthy, because if we're going to have a strong economy, first we have to have strong minds and strong bodies, then we're going to have to create local food businesses. It's at the very heart of whether or not we're going to be an entrepreneurial democracy with some modicum of prosperity or an uneconomic corporate welfare state. So what is happening to Evergreen Farm, even though it's my tiny, wonderful organic farm here in Hardeman County, is really it's the greatest threat to all of our future. So let's pray now that Congress does not have any more energy or let's pray that they don't have any more energy for evil doing now that they've processed 4,000-plus pages of financial and health care bills requiring many more pages, multiples of pages of regulation. But there is a food safety bill pending in Congress which could drive even more Evergreen Farms out of business. A note on my trip to London, there are three posts up on the blog. It was a wonderful time. London is noticeably more prosperous and alive than any part of the U.S. I've been to in the last few years. I suspect that $12 trillion in bailouts, that process was richer for London than any U.S. city. One of the high points of my visit was I was in Liverpool Station having dinner when Spain won the World Cup and watched thousands of young Spaniards brimming with pride pour through the station. It was wonderful to see literally thousands of young people, you know, feeling pride about their nation and what they're a part of. It was good to see. One of the things I watched in London was a presentation of the higher provisions relating to withholding taxes and reporting. There's a good piece up on the blog dated April 13th, 2010, about those provisions. And I also saw, or the presentation included parts of what was expected to pass in this Financial Reform Act. And if you look at what passed in both the Hire Act and what was expected to pass in the Financial Reform Act, it's essentially a dramatic increase in capital controls. If I was a foreign institution, I would do much to separate out my non-U.S. business from my U.S. business, or simply avoid doing business in the U.S. If I'm a foreign investor, I would avoid investment in U.S. securities and funds, and particularly avoid being commingled with U.S. investors. Because essentially, at the end of the day, what these provisions do is require a sharing of information which compromises privacy and security for all investors, U.S. and non-U.S. investors alike, depending on the fact patterns. But there's no doubt about it. It's capital controls by complexity, and it was very chilling to hear. Okay, ask Catherine. Several good questions and very much questions about, I'll call the devil is in the details. One was a story went around last week about the possibility that if you sell $600 of coins to a precious metals dealer, that you will receive a 1099 form for anything of $600 and over. In theory, that's true. The Health Care Act, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010, included a provision that businesses would have to give a 1099 form to anybody they paid $600 or more to for any reason. Now, regulations haven't been promulgated on the Health Care Act, including this provision, so let's see what happens. It will go into effect. It's effective 2012, so it's not something you have to grapple with this year or next, but the reality is it doesn't just apply to coins. It applies to everything, and to say that it's an expensive and draconian provision for all business, particularly small business, is an understatement. Again, there's a post about it up on the blog dated May 7th, so go read it. It's a special Solari report and very good. We had another question on the foreign bank and financial accounts FBAR 2010, which is a requirement to report all offshore assets. Again, really a form of capital controls. We did a blog post on it on June 6th, which links to all our prior blog posts on it. We spent a lot of time reporting and covering the FBAR provisions. The thing that had happened to inspire the June 6th post, among others, was that they did promulgate proposed regulations, and one of the things we believe is that those proposed regulations now ensure that precious metals holdings abroad do qualify for an FBAR form. I would say that that is not necessarily a consensus view. We know other experts in tax, certainly tax preparers who disagree, and I would absolutely defer to your tax preparer. But if you have financial accounts or precious metal holdings abroad, you absolutely want to make sure that you've brought that to the attention of whoever prepares your taxes and ask them whether or not it's appropriate for you to be making FBAR holdings. And again, I would point you to that blog post on June 6th, which also links to all of our others. FBAR, it's another tiny but complex piece of paperwork in the march to more serious capital controls. I just want to note on the FBAR something which I recommend in a lot of different venues. I have recommended that if you're talking about a bank or other holding that has online access, using XX or some symbol other than the actual number, so that you don't turn in your complete holding number. And the reason for that is that any data like this going to the government is very, very insecure. And so the identity theft problem is a real one when you give this kind of data to the government to be managed by corporate contractors who provide wide access to a variety of temporary workers. So I would, if your tax preparer will go along with sort of holding back two of the numbers, providing the N numbers is plenty for the government to identify the account to the provider. So it should be something a tax preparer would agree to do. Okay, well, that's it for Ask Catherine. And now on to a wonderful interview today, pre-recorded with Bob Sullivan. We'll play it now. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Bob Sullivan, and I want to just tell you the story of how I found Bob Sullivan. I was talking to Terry Cullen, who's the author of the Wall Street Journal Guide to Identity Theft, and at one point she said to me, you know, I'm not the top reporter in the country or the world on identity theft. She said, by far and away, the top guy is Bob Sullivan over at MSNBC. And sure enough, I got his wonderful book, Your Evil Twin, Between the Identity Theft Epidemic, and I had to agree with Terry. His work on this topic is quite extraordinary. Bob's been a reporter for nearly two decades. For the past 13 years, he's covered both computer crime and consumer affairs for MSNBC.com. His work is on their blog, The Red Tape Chronicles, and you can link to it from our blog under the personal finance section. His first book, Your Evil Twin, was on identity theft. His second book, Gotcha Capitalism, exposes the hidden fees that drain all of our budgets. His third book, which I also strongly recommend, I just finished it, is Stop Getting Ripped Off, and it is a wonderful roadmap for consumers on how to both protect themselves from the corrupt and waste transactions that bedevil us all, but also how, if we all collectively do that, we really can start to change the corruption in the culture that we're dealing with. So, Bob, it's a real pleasure to have you on the Solari Report and to have your work available to us through your books and your blogging. It's a tremendous body of work.
That's very nice of you. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, tell me, what is identity theft? And if you can define it quickly, you're a better man than me.
Well, in my book, what I describe is that each one of us, when we're born, has something that I call your digital twin. So you're born, you're flesh and blood, but over here is a piece of paper, probably a birth certificate. And that starts your digital twin down a road, where there's a set of numbers and names and paperwork that identifies you in this other digital world. So that's fine, although it's a little alarming for people to think of their own digital twin. But the problem is, it's very, very easy. Well, copying you would be a lot of work for someone to mimic who you were in the physical world. Copying your digital twin is easy. And in fact, copying is really the wrong word for it. When someone takes your credit card number or they take your driver's license number, they copy it down, they use it in another way. Computers can't tell the difference between the original and the copy. Therefore, they are you. When they're using your social security number to get a job at a meat packing plant, when they're using your credit card number to buy a $1,000 camera on Amazon, they're not really your identity thief. They're your digital twin. They've taken over your identity.
Right. They've your identity is being hijacked.
Yeah. They are you. And there's not a lot of great ways to figure out who is who and who's the rightful owner of that paperwork from the beginning. Identity theft has been defined a lot of ways. Actually, it's been a sort of torture term. And mostly over this, there's something like 10 million victims a year, but about two-thirds of them are simple credit card fraud. And for the vast majority of cases, that's not a big deal to consumers. All they have to do is call up their credit card company and complain and get taken care of rather quickly. And the industry really wants to parse that group out since that's such a simple case. Concentrate focus of identity theft on much more serious crimes like account create. Someone makes a new debit card in your name and steals thousands of dollars or does something much worse than that. So that's why identity theft has been difficult to define over the last 10 years or so, because there's a lot of wrangling in the industry. But for me, it's simple. It's someone else becoming your digital twin.
And this can happen not only to you. It can happen to other people in your family. It can happen to your children. There are a couple of stories you tell in Evil Twin where it happens to people's kids, and it's very chilling.
Yeah, when it happens to your child, and normally we don't discover identity theft until it hurts us in some way. Someone can run around pretending to be the virtual you for years, and until you try to buy a house or maybe get a loan for college or something like that, it just doesn't come up. And that's why child ID theft is such a terrible crime, because in plenty of cases, it can go on for 10 or 15 years before anyone finds out. And then, obviously, it really hurts if your credit is ruined before you even start your adult life.
Now, identity theft has grown. I mean, when I was, 20 years ago, you never even heard of this. But it seems as though it's just exploded onto the scene and grown dramatically. What's the history of this really as a crime?
Well, there's two things that led to it just suddenly exploding. And there were always forms of identity theft. in the past, it might have taken the form of something simple like insurance fraud, where someone would lie about who they were to get insurance, or lie about who they were to get a job. But the most significant event was the flow of easy credit, and in this, there's a neat parallel to a lot of other large societal problems we have, including the downturn of the economy. Identity theft really became an enormous crime the day that it was possible for you and I and most folks out there to walk into an electronic store with nothing in our pocket and 10 minutes later to walk out with a $2,000 television set because we signed some papers. Easy credit, instant credit, became this invitation to crime. And we all know how that's affected the housing market.
Right.
I think we also know that credit flowed too easily for a very long time. And the canary in the coal mine for me of this economic crisis was identity theft. And it became so easy for criminals to again, with almost nothing to prove who they were, to steal $2,000, $3,000, $4,000. And there are cases where ID thieves actually were able to steal homes, physical homes, take out home equity loans on properties they didn't have just because they signed the right papers. That was a sign that things were too easy.
Some of the most amazing stories in your book are the ease with which criminals can literally get a hold of a massive amount of data about a person, and pretty quickly. Even I was astonished at some of the stories.
The numbers are almost incomprehensible, but there was an arrest and an indictment last year of a fellow in Florida who had stolen about 30 million credit card numbers. 30 million. Essentially, one for every 5 U.S. adults. Just that one crime. And then he and his gang set about parsing them out over several years. And even though we've long since caught him and many members of his gang, those numbers are still filtering their way through the system. It's not an exaggeration to think that probably somewhere around 1 out of 3 U.S. adults has had this happen to them, has had at least someone steal their credit card over the
right.
past 10 years.
Now, what? One of the problems that made it difficult to slow this kind of crime down or deal with it was there were real jurisdictional issues. So if I live in a county in Tennessee, and I'm the target of an identity theft involving my credit card by somebody in Bulgaria, then the question is, what is the jurisdictional? Who has jurisdictional authority? Who can do something?
Yeah, well, there's interstate jurisdiction, so this is a very common problem. When you go to your local police officer and say, someone's stolen my identity, turns out it's done in Texas. Until fairly recently, your local police officer would tell you to call Texas, and that wouldn't get you anywhere.
Right.
And that's a small problem compared to the one you just laid out, which is, what do you do with criminals in Romania?
Right.
I mean, and the answer is basically nothing. I mean, there have been some pretty strong efforts at international cooperation over the last few years. And I know in the case of Romania in particular, I was actually there at a conference not too long ago, and the government there understands very well that countries like Romania have a terrible international reputation when it comes to finance, and that's really hurting their investment, their international investment prospects. So they're working hard to come up with extradition plans, and there are international laws in place. But the truth is, if this happens to you right now and the criminal is overseas, you might as well just chalk it up to experience and move forward.
Now, if they are in the United States, then it's the jurisdiction of your local county. In other words, you should be able to do a local police report.
Yeah, that is, there's been several things that have improved since I first started writing about this many years ago, and I would say that's the biggest one. There was a time when you could go to the police station and there wouldn't be a single officer there who had email, let alone the ability to investigate a digital crime.
Right.
And many of them wouldn't have even heard of identity theft or wouldn't recognize it from its symptoms. That's no longer true. And I'll tell you that one good reason for that is police officers and district attorneys and judges have all been victims now. So now they're willing to get involved. So and there are state and federal laws which require your local police officer, your local police station to take a police report from you. And you can also file a report with the Federal Trade Commission called an identity theft affidavit. Very, very important to do all those things because you have a new set of rights that kick in when you file those reports with your insurance company, with the Federal Trade Commission, and even with your creditor, which is the big problem. And one thing I try to remind people as often as I can, identity theft is a weird crime because there's no blood. And the truth is, in most cases, there's very little financial loss. There are situations where people do lose money, but in most cases, people get their money back eventually. That's not the problem. The problem is it can be just this paperwork nightmare for years, and it can ruin people's credit, and often does. And so the problem isn't really with you fighting back against the criminal as much as it's you fighting back against the system, and specifically against
right.
credit bureaus. So
now,
really
why does the Federal Trade Commission have jurisdiction?
Because Congress gave it to them. Nobody really knew what to do with this crime 7 or 8 years ago, and Congress actually passed the law instructing the Federal Trade Commission to maintain this database and to have jurisdiction over the crime.
Now, if I file a report with the Federal Trade Commission, does that protect me in the case, for example, where there's been identity theft and the person who's stolen my identity has committed a crime? Does that protect me or does that help me handle that situation if I should? I was very touched by some of the stories of people being picked up and put in jail for.
And arrested, yeah. Oh, sure.
Arrested for something that their evil twin had done.
Not necessarily. In fact, that problem you're describing there, criminal identity theft is what I call it. Is so severe that there are several states, Virginia is one of them, that now have something that they call an identity theft passport. So it's sort of a get-out-of-jail-free card, if you will. So if you're
right.
pulled over and they run your background and they think that you're a criminal, they whip out this card and say, no, I'm a victim of identity theft. And that's something that if you have any inkling, any of your listeners do, that they've been through this, that they really need to investigate. That's a horrible crime, and you have to imagine what it's like. Let's say you're pulled over at 11:30 at night on a rainy night sometime, and a police officer runs a computer check, and it says that you're a felon. You know, they're gonna put the cuffs on and ask questions later. That's just how that works.
Right.
So you have to be prepared for that.
Well, you in your book, you list it's a wonderful list of things that each one of us can do to protect ourselves against identity theft. I thought maybe we could go through one of them, and of course the number one thing I start with is keeping really excellent financial records.
Yeah. The key here for identity theft victims is actually not prevention, it's restoration. There's actually very little you can do in this big universe where your data is shared so liberally by so many companies. There's not a lot you can do if a hacker breaks into a big e-commerce company and steals your credit card. But what you can do, and what really works effectively, is find out that it's happened as soon as possible and handle it. The longer that the problem goes undetected, the worse it will be to fix it. So people who do a really good job of being on top of their finances, and it's funny how this is kind of like if you eat well, it has lots of benefits, not just losing weight. If you take care of your finances well, it has lots of benefits, a happier, more comfortable financial life, and less fear from identity theft is one of the great byproducts of it. So I am a fan. I know there's a long time where people were afraid to do things online with credit cards, do online shopping, online banking. They thought that might increase their risk of identity theft. I don't believe that's true. But I do think it quite liberally helps you recover from identity theft. I think it's a great idea to look at your credit card online every few days. Just take
right.
30 seconds. Make sure nothing's weird there. Look at your online bank statement even more often. That's important. And you can use these tools for early detection and to fix the problem before it snowballs.
Right. So monitoring accounts is important.
Right.
One of the things that you said that I also loved was the idea of hanging up on telemarketers quickly.
Yeah, it is. That's being sold. It's still in the market, I believe, and it's a box you put down next to your phone. And when a telemarketer calls, you press a button on this box, and it says, please do not call this phone number anymore. This household does not accept unsolicited calls. And people pay $20 for this, which is stunning to me, because you really can just hang up the phone.
Right.
But
I never heard of that. Well, I always say to them, please remove me from your database.
Yeah. It does actually. It is good to say, remove me from your list. It's 50-50 if they're calling you that they're already violating, the do not call list. So you know, it's worth saying, but yeah, I mean, at least just hang up. You don't have to.
Right, but whatever you do, do not give your data to strangers. Be very, very careful who you give your data to for any reason.
Yeah, and, you know, there are, I hear every day, I read about all these scams on the Red Tape Chronicles, and I hear all sorts of narratives that are very, very convincing. I know no one ever thinks they'll fall for a con artist who calls a house, or, you know, even a company that's selling a, you know, relatively bogus product. Everyone thinks they're too smart to fall for these things until they do, and they do all the
right.
time. And, you know, so a very simple piece of advice I always give people, at least ask for a phone number and call back. If someone is calling you illegitimately, it'll eliminate about 99% of the criminals if you just ask for their phone number, hang up, and call them back. They won't want to give you a phone number, and if you do, that won't get, you know, the same salesperson. And so, you know, just hang up is great advice, but if for some reason you're enticed to hear a little bit more about what they have to say, ask for their phone number and just hang up, and we'll leave the advice at that. That's simple but very effective.
Now, one of the things we set up all of our offices, and we're very, very good about, and it was because I spent so much time in litigation once upon a time, is just shredding everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're not going to file it, we're going to shred it. If it's going to go out of here, you know, now, if it doesn't have an address or any name on it, then we'll recycle it. The shredding all goes into the compost, most of it. So, but nothing with a name or address here leaves without being shredded. And I think shredding is just a very, very good discipline. Especially the credit, you point this out very well, when you get unsolicited credit card offers, make sure those all get shredded before they go into the trash.
You know, it's true. Businesses have to shred, essentially. There's a Federal Trade Commission law now, a regulation that requires them to properly dispose of any kind of personal information they collect. So if you run any kind of a small business, and by the way, that can mean, there are some interpretations of that to mean if you hire a nanny, and obviously you need some of the nanny's paperwork, then you have to be very careful how you dispose of her personal identification,
right.
Which is great. Shredding certainly is useful, and I think, you know, people get these pre-approved applications, they get all sorts of other ticking identity theft time bombs in the mail, and they're very worthwhile shredding. But I would like to just reiterate what I often do, which is dumpster diving, which can be the cause of identity theft, someone reaching into your trash or reaching into your recycling.
Uh-huh.
It still causes a very small percentage of identity theft. And so I don't want people to have the idea that because they shred that they're very well protected. That's probably not the case.
Oh, no, that's a good point. Because I used to be a government official, and I used to just faint at the insecurity of the data that goes into government. If you look at how all the databases were managed by contractors and the temporary workers, and, you know, it was... we regularly had a problem with employees sort of trading data with private parties for a variety of benefits. And it used to just scare me to death. I mean, I really, as a practical matter, I didn't think there was any privacy of data that you give to the government. So if you look at all the people we're providing massive amounts of data to, I just think that the chances of all of those digital databases being insecure is extraordinary, whether it's, you know, whether it's what we give to the government or medical data, anything. So I'm sure that, yeah. One thing you did mention, because I live in a rural area and this comes up a lot, is the potential insecurity of your mail and the benefits. I most people in this area now, because of identity theft and crime, use post office boxes and don't, their outgoing mail, they don't put in the post office, you know, into their box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sadly, that which I thought was a very nice old world feature, giving your mail to your postal carrier, leaving it in your box, putting that little flag up. The little flag now is just as a red flag to a criminal to go by and assume there's probably bills that you paid in there, so there's endorsed checks even in your mail. So that's unfortunate. Mail security is a really good idea. And you know, again, I try to not make this a laundry list of homework because. You know, if I tell people to shred everything and to get P.O. boxes, and I mean, all that's effective, and I applaud people who want to do that. But most of us are so busy, can't keep on track of those things. But again, this is where I think it's really advisable to do two things. One is to have really good grasp of when your bills come, and this is good personal finance planning as well. You know, you may have 9 or 10 bills every month you got to pay, the water bill, the mortgage, the car insurance. Know when they're coming, and so if they're missing, you have a sense something's gone wrong, and you can react. That's one thing. But the other is there's quite a movement now for electronic billing, which saves the company a stamp and saves the earth a little bit of paper, and perhaps over the long term saves a few trees, which I think is good, but it also keeps the stuff out of your mailbox. And so I think that the people should really strongly consider turning to e-bills, saving themselves a little bit of hassle that way. And, you know, paying their bills online and getting their bills online is, I think, safer than having all the mail floating around.
Yeah, especially if they're monitoring. So it gets back to keeping good records and monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things I've done is frozen my credit report. What do you think about that?
That puts you in the upper echelon of identity theft safety. It does. I was one of the folks who were arguing for the right to freeze credit reports for a very long time before it came about. So
really? Oh, well, thank
great.
You very much for that.
Yeah, it's individual states kind of one by one started passing laws enabling consumers to do this.
Uh-huh.
How much do you have to pay to do this?
I forget. I know we have to pay something to get it unfrozen every time we need to get it unfrozen. But my feeling is it's worth paying it to just not worry about it. I'll tell you what happened. I was talking to a person who is in one of the industries I deal with, who's a very well-respected person and important to me from a business standpoint. And I had to call them for a reason. I'd never spoken to them before, and I said, Stephen, it's so nice to speak with you, if only by phone. And he said, well, we've met. And I said, I don't remember meeting. And he said, oh, I just was in a conference 2 months ago in Arizona, and we met there. And I said, I wasn't in a conference in Arizona 2 months ago. I haven't been in a conference in Arizona for several years. And he said, no, there was a Catherine Austin Fitz at all the meetings, and she introduced herself, and I talked to her. I talked to you. I said, that wasn't me. And it just chilled me to the bone. You know, it's a very chilling feeling when these things happen. And that's when I said, okay, I'm going to get really serious about this. And I just, so as far as I know, the conference in Arizona didn't cost me anything, but, that's when I said, okay, I'm going to get really serious, and I froze the credit report.
That's how most people come across freezing, because they're victims. And in many states, it's actually free to victims, at least to freeze it. As you mentioned, probably have to pay to thaw it if you want to buy a car or buy a house. $10.
Yeah, and it's it also encourages you not to take on debt because it's too hard to unfreeze your credit report.
Well, it gives you a bit of pause before you apply for a new Macy's card or a new retail store credit card.
Uh-huh.
And what's wrong with that?
One of the things I feel helps is I really encourage my clients and subscribers to bank with I encourage a lot of local banking, but banking with an institution where they can have a long-standing relationship with someone and they're known personally.
Mm-hmm.
And I also maintain a relationship and always have with one or more attorneys and accountants who I try to have long-standing relationships with. And when we get into situations where it's very important, particularly to communicate to enforcement that this person is the real Catherine Austin Fitz and is legitimate and does have a real problem, having a good attorney or a good CPA can help you do that. And if you have other reasons to afford a person like that, I really think it helps to have a professional witness who can just authenticate that you are who you are and that you're not a criminal.
Well, and that's probably true in a lot of elements of our society today, right? That having it's like having a family doctor, having a family lawyer
right.
is incredibly important. One point I try to make often is that there are so many elements to this. I, of course, run around telling people they should watch their bills carefully for identity theft. And next week you'll go to the dentist, and the dentist will say, why aren't you getting your teeth cleaned more frequently? And then you'll go to your gas station, and the mechanic there will say, why aren't you changing your oil more frequently? And everybody, we're all getting yelled at all the time
right,
by people.
Right, right.
But this is what we should worry about. And people are overwhelmed by all this. There's too much to worry about.
Right.
You might think about your credit once every 5 years, really. if you're like most adults, if it's not either a crisis for you or you're not right in the market for buying a home. And that means you've never heard or you vaguely remember the terms, you know, TransUnion, Experian, and Equifax. And so when something bad happens, how are you supposed to know the five steps to take to save yourself from identity theft? And that's, you know, why people like me write books and have columns and you have radio shows like this.
Right.
But, you know, I sympathize a lot with someone who finds themselves in the middle of this problem and doesn't know where to take the first step. So that's why having an accountant friend, a lawyer friend, who really does actually know the ropes is incredibly important.
Well, if it does happen, let's walk through the steps. The first is to file with the FTC?
Yeah. Well, the first step should be to go to the three credit bureaus and at least file what's called a fraud alert, which is stage one protection, and the credit freeze that you have is stage two protection. So it's pretty easy. You go to Experian.com or Equifax.com or TransUnion.com and look for the word alert, and when you file an alert with one of those companies, they're supposed to spread it to the other two. And what that does is it tells anyone who in the future might grant credit in your name that they have to take extraordinary measures to make sure that you are you. They can still grant it. With a freeze, you can't grant it at all.
Right.
They at least have to try to verify a phone number, or verify a driver's license, something else. It puts a red flag on your account. So that really is the first thing. Simultaneous with that, of course, you have to, you know, depending on how you found out about it, you need to go to that institution right away and argue for yourself. If the bank, a debit card that's been compromised, so you're actually out money, which is, you know, often a real problem, you know, go to them right away and appeal to get your money back or cancel the credit card or go to, you know, identity theft is very broad. There's identity theft, a big and growing problem. Someone becomes you on Facebook, think about all the things that they can do to you personally and your reputation and communicate with your friends. And there are plenty of scams that involve impersonating someone on Facebook and begging them money or something like that. So if that's the form of ID theft that you've discovered, make sure you go to them and restore your account. And it's particularly if we're talking about websites, you know, it's really common, let's say, and so you give up your password to Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, you have to go to Amazon and change your password, but you probably are going to have to go to all the other websites you visit, too, because however much we give people advice telling them not to do this, it's honestly practical for most people to use the same password everywhere.
Right.
So, you know, if that's the kind of identity theft, it's really important to sit down and spend a couple hours going through all of the websites you visit and changing all your passwords. And again, it's things you might not think about. Like maybe you have a rarely used Yahoo email account and that you use that same password that's now compromised. Well, you know, guess what? When criminals get a password and a username, they go to the top 100 websites right away and try them on all of them, see if they've got some keys that work in these houses. And if someone who's, who gets access to an email account that everyone thinks belongs to you, they can really do a lot of damage to you. So this is where I think people really need to pay attention.
I almost think that, you know, one of the number one pieces of advice is if something happens, then you need to immediately budget serious time to take care of this immediately.
I think that's well said, yeah.
Not let it slide.
It's going to take time. It's going to be annoying. I mean, we're talking about all the things in life that are annoying, you know, calling your doing credit cards, all these things.
Right.
Yeah, take a day off of work and focus on it because you're not going to be able to do it in the quick lunch hour.
Now, one thing you pointed out in your book is that others do recommend changing social security numbers, and that's something that you don't recommend.
Yeah,
I'd love for you to just say 2 minutes about that.
Sure. This I do with a bit of a heavy heart because there are extreme examples where I know it happens and it probably is best in very rare cases. But for the most part, changing your social security number, first of all, the Social Security Administration generally won't do it. They won't issue you a new number. Very, very hard to go through an appeals process for that. But also, a couple of things happen. First, you lose, in many ways, you can lose your college education records. They will no longer be attached to you. You can lose licenses and certifications that you have, or at least it will look really odd when you apply for a job. And, you know, you'll lose the bad background, but you'll also lose all the good background. And then, lastly, what's tragically sad is so often at the credit bureaus, the new number and the old number get linked anyway. Eventually, they're cross-linked. Those databases are constantly looking for people who are doing just this kind of crime. And so you might not escape keep a bad record anyway if you change your social security number. So for all those reasons, generally, it's not advisable to try to do that.
Now, one of the things that, and this just happened recently to a client of mine, I started about 4 or 5 years ago, Bob, to get letters from companies saying, we've lost some of our data and we are now paying for this service. And if you, you know, if you take this code number, you can sign up at their website and you'll get a year's free, these different services that sort of protect you against identity theft. The first time it happened, it was a bank recommending it, and the firm they were recommending is a firm I wouldn't trust with my name, let alone my personal data. But I wondered, you know, are any of those services, do any of those services make economic sense to use?
Well, I think they make economic sense to use when someone gives you them for free.
Okay.
You know, those letters that went out in such a flurry a couple of years ago, I mean, again, I believe the number, according to the Poneman Research Group, is that 1 in 2 Americans got one of those, I call them Dear John data letters. Dear John,
uh-huh.
I'm sorry. We lost your data. Good luck. I break it to you this way.
They're very chilling letters.
They are.
One of them came to me, and I just got a client forwarding me one yesterday from a healthcare insurer. So that's more than just personal financial data. It's all sorts of very private, intimate healthcare data.
It is very scary when you start to think beyond, you know, basic credit card theft. What's possible, isn't it? The chilling part of these letters to me is that they're often really vague. It'll say, we, in the course of reviewing our records, we realize that some of your information might have been compromised by someone somewhere. And again, you know, we're sorry, here's 3 months free credit monitoring. And that's all you get. And you're left with all these questions. You know, what exactly is it? What should I be looking out for? You know, I mean, is it, did they find out about the drugs I'm taking, or did they only find out, you know, what my car license plate is? You know, those are two very different things.
Tell us, I want to talk a little bit before we close about stop getting ripped off, but before we finish up on identity theft, what are the things not to do? What are the things you absolutely must not do in either avoiding or achieving restoration from identity theft?
Well, a big no is to click on links in emails. There was very clear instructions from just about all corners never to click on links in emails, because those phishing emails, those emails that look like they're from eBay or your bank but aren't, they'll come with something that says, click here to log in. You click there and you log in, but you're really logging in on a fake website. For a while, I think there was so much news about that that we all reached that point in the learning curve. Just like nowadays, we don't download random attachments in our email.
Right.
But I think the news has gone away, first of all. And second of all, there are tons of services, for my money, Facebook chief among them, that interact with their consumers exactly the same way that fishers do. So Facebook is constantly sending out emails with links that you're supposed to click on. And it's very easy to mimic them. And so I think people are confused again, and there's a lot of confusion about what to click on, what not to click on. And I just wish everybody would just never click on any of these links and just go right to their browser and type newsline.com, type facebook.com, type msnbc.com. It only takes a second, and that'll keep you safe. There are some more technical ways to protect yourself when you're using links and email. I have some advice for that on the website, but simple advice often works best for folks. And still, I would say the biggest problem that people fall into is not being safe enough when they're browsing around and clicking around when they're using the web.
So just be careful, be prudent online. I know one of the things you mentioned is having good passwords, and I'm not sure everybody knows what a good password is.
With good passwords are first and foremost words that aren't in the dictionary. Very trivial for criminals to attempt 5,000, 10,000, 100,000 tries at a website with your username and the dictionary nearby. The computer just filters in all the words from A to Z. So at a very minimum, you know, not a word that's in the dictionary. This means make something up. And there are a lot of tricks, and the folks who work in the technology industry have come up with. Here's one I like. You know, take the first letter of a sentence that you know that's, you know, like I grew up on First Street. You know, the letter I, the letter G, the letter U, and then the number 1, and then the letter S. And that'll give you a password that is easy for you to remember because it's a phrase that you can recognize, but probably very hard for someone to guess. There's a lot of great password tips if you just do a little bit of searching on the Internet for them.
Okay. Okay, well, that's it for Identity Theft. Stop Getting Ripped Off, I have to tell you, is one of the most amazing books I've ever read for personal finance. And your subtitle is Why Consumers Get Screwed and How You Can Always Get a Fair Deal. And it's remarkable, Bob, because I think to make math understandable and easily accessible to people who don't love math is one of the things you do. You really explain how it is that so much of these sort of financial tricks are achieved at the consumer level. So you find a way of making us feel not terrible that this has been happening to us, which I thought was quite remarkable. And it's very entertaining and interesting. But you really do provide ways for consumers to understand whether it's credit cards or student loans. You go through student loans, cell phones, really how to make sure they're getting the most for their money. And I'd love for you to just say a little bit about what inspired you to write this book, how it really happened. Because it's a remarkable book, and I recommend it to everybody on the call.
Thank you very much. That's lovely of you to say. I wrote a blog called The Red Tape Chronicles for MSNBC, and I've been doing it for about 5 years. It started right after Hurricane Katrina. I was down there covering the hassles that victims were going through. For some reason, I'm always attracted to paperwork hassles. I don't know, all the stuff that I hate to do myself. I mean, it's funny because I got a really interesting question once when I was on NPR. Terry Gross asked me, well, you must be Mr. Uber Perfect Consumer, and I'm actually the exact opposite. All these things make my blood pressure explode, which is I think why I sympathize with a lot of the people who are my readers. This is not easy. It's annoying, and it's designed to be so. And that's why, you know, we're all in this together, and I try to play as much a cheerleader as anything else for people to take these things on. But I was in New Orleans, and I was learning about all the struggles that people had to go through just to get their relief checks from the government, and then the struggles they had with their credit scores and their credit reports, because all these people weren't paying mortgages on houses that no longer existed anymore. I mean, it was the ultimate red tape nightmare. And I did a series of stories about all that, and every time I did one, I would get emails from all around the country from people saying, and what about me? And, you know, my house hasn't blown away, but I have exactly the same problem with Bank of America, with Citibank, with my cable provider that you're describing here. And it just turns out there's endless fodder as a journalist.
It's unbelievable. It's kind of like all the smartest people in the world sit around in the rooms at a big bank and figure out how to steal.
Yeah. No,
illegally
really
steal. It's amazing.
Yeah, I really do think I'm more than think that that's true. I know that that's true. I've interviewed some of them.
Yeah.
They're in this dark room, and they conjure up all manner of ways. And it's funny because it's not that unlike, you know, the plot of the movie Office Space, where if somebody figures out how to steal a tenth of a penny, you know, 100,000 times day after day, they get rich. When folks in Office Space did it, it was a crime, but when a bank does it, it's called a business plan.
Right.
Never understood the difference, but that's what I heard about.
What I would really recommend to my subscribers is, because I know, again, we're all busy, but if you're thinking about buying a car or buying a home, this is a book worth getting. And, you know, I think a good read, particularly if the pertinent chapters on whatever it is you're about to do, student loans, pay TV, cell phones, insurance, will really save you some heartburn and some money. So it's a great achievement, Bob. Well, in closing, if you could tell us how we can follow you and support your work. Do any more books in planning?
I have a lot of ideas, but no commitments yet. Right now I'm still, you know, touring out supporting this book, and I have a few other adventures up my sleeve. But at the moment, the best way to follow me is I write this column, The Red Tape Chronicles, on MSNBC. Go to the website, go directly to it at redtape.msnbc.com. And that's really where most of my work appears. But I also have a Facebook page that's pretty easy to find, and if you sign up as a fan there, you'll get alerts every time I do something.
Okay.
And you can also visit me personally at bobsullivan.net, not .com.net.
One of the things I loved in Stop Getting Ripped Off was the point that literally if every consumer became savvy at protecting themselves from being ripped off, it would really change the fundamental incentives in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in fact, by each one of us simply protecting ourselves and our family, we would make an important contribution to really a sea change in affecting how the financial system works. And so it's sort of a very bottom-up emergent way to bring about change. But I think deep
inside, it's patriotic to fight back against all this. I mean, that's what we have to do to fix our economy.
Right. I happen to believe that you can get, one of the things you say is hold a grudge. When somebody does something, you want to complain, you want to attend to it, and you want to hold a grudge. You never want to do business with that organization again. I think that's great advice. And I just have to say, as a matter of politics, I think that's a very important political action that we can all take, and it can have really dramatic impact. So I think, you know, that's why I think if your work is a very important contribution to bringing about really important systemic change. So, Bob, thank you very much for joining us for this O'Leary Report. We appreciate you. We appreciate what you're doing. And if we can ever do anything to support you, just let us know.
That's very nice of you. Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Bob. Have a wonderful day.
Okay, you too.
Okay, Bob Sullivan, again, we're going to post a checklist next week of the actions we discussed in tonight's interview. So if you didn't have time to or didn't have the inclination to take notes, the checklist will be up there. We look forward to being with you again next week. We've got Nick Beglich of Earth Pulse, the leading expert on HARP. That's a follow-up to the interviews that we did with Clifford Carnicom on the Global Spraying Program. HARP came up again and again. So we're going to talk about what it is and what it means and also the sort of biohazards of ELF pollution. Then on August 5th, we have Charles Murray, president of the American Institute for Economic Research. We're going to review their resources to help you with financial planning. It's a wonderful institution. I'm a member. And we're going to be focusing on one of their most useful books, I think, called If Something Should Happen, which teaches you how to organize your financial and legal affairs if you're not able to manage things yourself at some point. But great best practices for running financial affairs for anybody. Great practical advice for both family and financial planning. So until next week, you're in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.